being served, Sir Axel Florent had entertained the table with a tale of a Targaryen princeling who kept an ape as a pet. This prince liked to dress the creature in his dead son's clothes and pretend he was a child, Sir Axel claimed. And from time to time he would propose marriages for him. The lord so honoured always declined politely, but of course they did decline. "Even dressed in silk and velvet, an ape remains an ape," Sir Axel said. "A wiser prince would have known that you cannot send an ape to do a man's work." The queen's men laughed, and several grinned at Davos. "I am no ape," he'd thought. "I am as much a lord as you, and a better man." But the memory is still stung. The seal gate had been closed for the night. Davos would not be able to return to the Merry Midwife till dawn. He was here for the night. He gazed up at old Fishfoot with his broken trident. "I have come through rain and rack and storm. I will not go back without doing what I came for, no matter how hopeless it may seem." He might have lost his fingers in his luck, but he was no ape in velvet. He was a king's hand. Castle Stair was a street with steps, a broad white stoneway that led up from the wolf's den by the water to the new castle on its hill. Marble mermaids lit the way as Davos climbed, bowls of burning whale oil cradled in their arms. When he reached the top, he turned to look behind him. From here he could see down into the harbours, both of them. Behind the jetty wall, the inner harbour was crowded with war galleys. Davos counted 23. Lord Wyman was a fat man, but not an idle one, it seemed. The gates of the new castle had been closed, but a postern opened when he shouted, and a guard emerged to ask his business. Davos showed him the black and gold ribbon that bore the royal seals. "I need to see Lord Manderley at once," he said. "My business is with him, and him alone."
John. "Big enough for you?" Snowflake speckled Tormund's broad face, melting in his hair and beard. The giants swayed slowly atop the mammoths as they rode past two by two. John's Garen shied, frightened by such strangeness, but whether it was the mammoths or their riders that scared him, it was hard to say. Even Ghost backed off a step, baring his teeth in a silent snarl. The dire wolf was big, but the mammoths were a deal bigger, and there were many and more of them. John took the horse in hand and held him still, so he could count the giants emerging from the blowing snow and pale mist that swirled along the milk water. He was well beyond 50 when Tormund said something, and he lost the count. There must be hundreds. No matter how many went past, they just seemed to keep coming. In old Nan's stories, giants were outsized men who lived in colossal castles, fought with huge swords, and walked about in boots a boy could hide in. These were something else, more bear-like than human, and as woolly as the mammoths they rode. Seated, it was hard to say how big they truly were. 10 feet tall, maybe, or 12, John thought, maybe 14, but no taller. Their sloping chests might have passed for those of men, but their arms hung down too far, and their lower torsos looked half again as wide as their upper. Their legs were shorter than their arms, but very thick, and they wore no boots at all. Their feet were broad splayed things, hard and horny and black. Neckless, their huge heavy heads thrust forward from between their shoulder blades, and their faces were squashed and brutal. Rat's eyes, no larger than beads, were almost lost within the folds of horny flesh, but they snuffled constantly, smelling as much as they saw. "They're not wearing skins," John realized. "That's hair." Shaggy pelts covered their bodies, thick below the waist, sparser above. The stink that came off them was choking, but perhaps that was the mammoths. And Joramun blew the horn of winter and woke giants from the earth. He looked for great swords 10 feet long, but saw only clubs. Most were just the limbs of dead trees, some still trailing shattered branches. A few had stone balls lashed to the ends to make colossal mauls. The song never says if the horn can put them back to sleep. One of the giants coming up on them looked older than the rest. His pelt was grey and streaked with white, and the mammoth he rode, larger than any of the others, was grey and white as well. Tormund shouted something up to him as he passed, harsh, clanging words, in a tongue that John did not comprehend. The giant's lips split apart to reveal a mouth full of huge square teeth, and he made a sound half belch and half rumble. After a moment, John realized he was laughing. The mammoth turned his massive head to regard the two of them briefly, one huge tusk passing over the top of John's head as the beast lumbered by, leaving huge footprints in the soft mud and fresh snow along the river. The giant shouted down something in the same coarse tongue that Tormund had used. "Was that their king?" asked John.
"Giants have no kings, no more than mammoths do, nor snow bears, nor the great whales of the grey sea. That was Magmar Tondorweg, Mag the Mighty. You can kneel to him if you like, he won't mind. I know your kneeler's knees must be itching for want of some king to bend to. Watch out he don't step on you, though. Giants have bad eyes, and might be he wouldn't see some little crow all the way down there by his feet."
"What did you say to him? Was that the old tongue?"
"Aye. I asked him if that was his father he was forking. They looked so much alike, except his father had a better smell."
"And what did he say to you?"
Tormund Thunderfist cracked a gap-toothed smile. "He asked me if that was my daughter riding there beside me with her smooth pink cheeks."
The wildling shook snow from his arm and turned his horse about. "It may be he never saw a man without a beard before.
Come, we start back. Mans grow sore wroth when I'm not found in my accustomed place."
John wheeled and followed Tormund back toward the head of the column, his new cloak hanging heavy from his shoulders. It was made of unwashed sheepskins, worn fleece side in, as the wildling suggested. He kept the snow off well enough, and at night it was good and warm, but he kept his black cloak as well, folded up beneath his saddle. "Is it true you killed a giant once?" he asked Tormund as they rode. Ghost loped silently beside them, leaving paw prints in the new fallen snow.
"Now why would you doubt a mighty man like me? It was winter, and I was half a boy, and stupid the way boys are. I went too far, and my horse died, and then a storm caught me, a true storm, not no little dustin' such as this. Ah! I knew I'd freeze to death before it broke, so I found me a sleeping giant, cut open her belly, and crawled up right inside her. Kept me warm enough, she did, but the stink ne'er did for me. The worst thing was, she woke up when the spring come and took me for a babe, suckled me for 3 whole moons before I could get away. Ah, there's times I miss the taste of giant's milk, though."
"If she nursed you, you couldn't have killed her."
"I never did. But see, you don't go spreading that about. Tormund Giant's Bane has a better ring to it than Tormund Giant's Babe, and that's the honest truth of it."
"So how did you come by your other names?" John asked. "Mans called you the Hornblower, didn't he? Mead King of Ruddy Hall, husband to bears, father to hosts." It was the hornblowing he particularly wanted to hear about, but he dare not ask too plainly. And Joramun blew the horn of winter and woke giants from the earth. Is that where they had come from? Them and their mammoths? Had Mance Raider found the horn of Joramun and given it to Thorman Thunderfist to blow?
"'Are all crows so curious?' asked Tormund. "'Well, here's a tale for you. "'It were another winter, colder even than the one I spent inside the giant, "'and snowing day and night, snowflakes as big as a head, not these little things. "'It snowed so hard the old village was half buried. "'I was in me ruddy hall, with only a cask of mead to keep me company "'and nothing to do but drink it.' The more I drank, the more I got to thinking about this woman lived close by, a fine, strong woman, with the biggest pair of tits she ever saw. She had a temper on her, that one, but oh, she could be warm, too, and in the depth of winter, a man needs his warmth. The more I drank, the more I thought about her, and the more I thought, the harder me member got. "'Till I couldn't suffer it no more. "'Fool that I was, I bundled myself up in furs from head to heels, "'wrapped a winding wool around me face, and set off to find her. "'The snow was coming down so hard, I got turned around once or twice, "'and the wind blew right through me and froze me bones, "'but finally I come on her, all bundled up like I was. "'The woman had a terrible temper, and she put up quite a fight.' When I laid hands on her, it was all I could do to carry her home and get her out of them furs. But when I did, oh, she was hotter even than I remembered, and we had a fine old time. And then I went to sleep. Next morning, when I woke, the snow had stopped, and the sun was shining. But I was in no fit state to enjoy it. All ripped and torn I was, and half my member bit right off. And there, on my floor, was a she-bear's pelt. And soon enough, the free folk were telling tales of this bald bear seen in the woods, with the queerest pair of cubs behind her. Ha! He slapped a meaty thigh. Would that I could find her again. She was fine to lay with, that bear. Never was a woman gave me such a fight. "'Nor such strong sons, neither.'
"'What could you do if you did find her?' John asked, smiling. "'You said she bit your member off.'
"'Only half. "'And half my member is twice as long as any other man's,'
Tormund snorted.
"'Now, as to you, is it true they cut your members off "'when they take you for the wall?'
"'No,' John said, affronted.
"'I think it must be true. "'Else, why refuse egret?' She'd hardly give you any fight at all, seems to me. The girl wants you in her. That's plain enough to see.
Too bloody plain, thought John, and it seems that half the column has seen it. He studied the falling snow so Tormund might not see him redden. I am a man of the night's watch, he reminded himself. So why did he feel like some blushing maid? He spent most of his days in Egret's company and most nights as well. Mansraider had not been blind to Rattleshirt's mistrust of the crow-come-over. So after he had given John his new sheepskin cloak, he had suggested that he might want to ride with Tormund Giantsbane instead. John had happily agreed, and the very next day Egret and Longspear Rick left Rattleshirt's band for Tormund's as well.
"'Free folk ride with who they want,' the girl told him. And we had a bellyful of bag of bones.
Every night when they made camp, Egret threw her sleeping skins down beside his own, no matter if he was near the fire or well away from it. Once he woke to find her nestling against him, her arm across his chest. He lay listening to her breathe for a long time, trying to ignore the tension in his groin. Rangers often shared skins for warmth, but warmth was not all Egret wanted. He suspected. After that, he had taken to using ghosts to keep her away. Old Nan used to tell stories about knights and their ladies who would sleep in a single bed with a blade between them for honour's sake, but he thought this must be the first time where a direwolf took the place of the sword. Even then, Egret persisted. The day before last, John had made the mistake of wishing he had hot water for a bath.
"Cold is better," she had said at once. "If you've got someone to warm you up after, the river's only part ice yet. Go on." John laughed. "You'd freeze me to death. Are all crows afraid of goose prickles? A little ice won't kill you. I'll jump in with you to prove it so."
"And ride the rest of the day with wet clothes, frozen to our skins?" he objected.
"John Snow, you know nothing. You don't go in with clothes."
"I don't go in at all," he said firmly, just before he heard Tormund Thunderfist bellowing for him. He hadn't, but never mind. The wildling seemed to think Ygritte a great beauty because of her hair. Red hair was rare among the free folk, and those who had it were said to be kissed by fire, which was supposed to be lucky. Lucky it might be, and red it certainly was, but Ygritte's hair was such a tangle that John was tempted to ask her if she only brushed it at the changing of the seasons. At a lord's court, the girl would never have been considered anything but common, he knew. She had a round, peasant face, a pug nose, and slightly crooked teeth, and her eyes were too far apart. John had noticed all that the first time he'd seen her, when his dirk had been at her throat. Lately, though, he was noticing some other things. When she grinned, the crooked teeth didn't seem to matter. And maybe her eyes were too far apart, but they were a pretty blue-grey colour, and lively as any eyes he knew. Sometimes she sang in a low, husky voice that stirred him, and sometimes by the cook fire, when she sat hugging her knees, with the flames waking echoes in her red hair, and looked at him just smiling. Well, that stirs some things as well. But he was a man of the night's watch. He had taken a vow. "I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children." He had said the words before the weirwood, before his father's gods. He could not unsay them, no more than he could admit the reason for his reluctance to Tormund Thunderfist, father to bears.
"Do you mislike the girl?"
Tormund asked him as they passed another 20 mammoths, these bearing wildlings in tall wooden towers instead of giants. "No, but I..." What can I say that he will believe? "I am still too young to wed."
"Wed?" Tormund laughed. "Who spoke of wedding? In the south must a man wed every girl he beds?"
John could feel himself turning red again. "She spoke for me when Rattleshirt would have killed me. I would not dishonour her."
"You're a free man now, and Ygritte is a free woman. What dishonour if you lay together?"
"I might get her with child."
"Aye, I'd hope so. A strong son or a lively laughing girl kissed by fire, eh? Where's the harm in that?"
Words failed him for a moment. The child would be a bastard.
"A bastard's weaker than other children. More sickly, more like to fail."
"No, but
you're bastard born yourself, and if Ygritte does not want a child, she will go to some woods witch and drink a cup of moon tea. You do not come into it once the seed is planted."
"I will not father a bastard." Tormund shook his shaggy head.
"What fools you kneelers be! Why did you steal the girl if you don't want her?"
"Steal? I never—"
"You did," said Tormund. "You slew the two she was with and carried her off. What do you call it?"
"I took her prisoner."
"You made her yield to you."
"Yes, but, Tormund, I swear I've never touched her."
"Are you certain they never cut your member off?"
Tormund gave a shrug, as if he would never understand such madness.
"Well, you're a free man now. But if you will not have the girl, best find yourself a she-bear. If a man does not use his member, it grows smaller and smaller, until one day he wants to piss and cannot find it."
John had no answer for that. Small wonder that the Seven Kingdoms thought the free folk scarcely human. They have no laws, no honour. Not even simple decency. They steal endlessly from each other, breed like beasts, prefer rape to marriage, and fill the world with base-born children. Yet he was growing fond of Tormund Giantsbane, great bag of wind and lies though he was. Longspear as well. And Ygritte?
No, I will not think about Ygritte. Along with the Tormans and the Longspears rode other sorts of wildlings, though, men like Rattleshirt and the Weeper, who would as soon slit you as spit on you. There was Harmer Dogshead, a squat keg of a woman, with cheeks like slabs of white meat, who hated dogs and killed one every fortnight to make a fresh head for her banner. Earless Stir, Magna of Thenn, whose own people thought him more god than lord. Varamir Sixskins, a small mouse of a man, whose steed was a savage white snow bear that stood 13 feet tall on its hind legs. And wherever the bear and Varamir went, three wolves and a shadow cat came following. John had been in his presence only once, and once had been enough. The mere sight of the man had made him bristle, even as the fur on the back of Ghost's neck had bristled at the sight of the bear and that long black-and-white cat. And there were folks fiercer even than Varamir. From the northernmost reaches of the haunted forest, the hidden valleys of the Frostfangs, and even queerer places, the men of the frozen shore, who rode in chariots made of walrus bones, pulled along by packs of savage dogs, the terrible Ice River clans, who were said to feast on human flesh, the cave dwellers, with their faces dyed blue and purple and green. With his own eyes, John had beheld the Hornfoot men trotting along in columns on bare soles as hard as boiled leather. He had not seen any Snarks or Grumpkins, but for all he knew, Tormund would be having some to supper. Half the wildling host had lived all their lives without so much as a glimpse of the wall, John judged, and most of those spoke no word of the common tongue. It did not matter. Mance Rayder spoke the old tongue, even sang in it, fingering his lute and filling the night with strange wild music. Mance had spent years assembling this vast plodding host, talking to this clan mother and that Magna, winning one village with sweet words and another with a song and a third with the edge of his sword, making peace between Harmer Dogshead and the Lord of Bones, between the Hornfoots and the Nightrunners, between the walrus men of the frozen shore and the cannibal clans of the great ice rivers, hammering 100 different daggers into one great spear aimed at the heart of the Seven Kingdoms. He had no crown nor scepter, no robes of silk and velvet, but it was plain to John that Mance Rayder was a king in more than name. John had joined the wildlings at Corran Halfhand's command.
"Ride with them, eat with them, fight with them," the ranger had told him the night before he died, "and watch."
But all his watching had learned him little. The Halfhand had suspected that the wildlings had gone up into the bleak and barren Frostfangs in search of some weapon, some power, some fell sorcery with which to break the wall. But if they had found any such, no one was boasting of it openly, or showing it to John. Nor had Mance Rayder confided any of his plans or strategies. Since that first night, he had hardly seen the man, save at a distance. "I will kill him, if I must." The prospect gave John no joy. There would be no honour in such a killing, and it would mean his own death as well. Yet he could not let the wildlings breach the wall to threaten Winterfell and the north, the Barrowlands and the Rills, White Harbour and the Stony Shore, even the Neck. For 8,000 years the men of House Stark had lived and died to protect their people against such ravagers and reavers. And, bastard-born or no, the same blood ran in his veins. Bran and Rickon are still at Winterfell besides. Maester Lewin, Sir Roderick, old Nan, Farlan the kennel-master, Micken at his forge, and Gage by his ovens, everyone I ever knew, everyone I ever loved. If John must slay a man he half admired and almost liked, to save them from the mercies of Rattleshirt and Harmer Dogshead and the earless Magnar of Thenn, that was what he meant to do. Still, he prayed his father's guards might spare him that bleak task. The host moved but slowly, burdened as it was by all the wildlings' herds and children and mean little treasures, and the snows had slowed its progress even more. Most of the column was out of the foothills now, oozing down along the west bank of the Milkwater like honey on a cold winter's morning, following the course of the river into the heart of the haunted forest. And somewhere close ahead, John knew, the fist of the first men loomed above the trees, home to 300 black brothers of the night's watch, armed, mounted, and waiting. The old bear had sent out other scouts besides the half-hand, and surely Jarman Buckwell or Thorin Smallwood would have returned by now with word of what was coming down out of the mountains. Mormont will not run, John thought. He is too old, and he has come too far. He will strike and damn the numbers. One day soon he would hear the sound of war horns and see a column of riders pounding down on them with black cloaks flapping and cold steel in their hands. 300 men could not hope to kill 100 times their number, of course, but John did not think they would need to. He need not slay 1,000, only 1. Mance is all that keeps them together. The king beyond the wall was doing all he could, yet the wildlings remained hopelessly undisciplined, and that made them vulnerable. Here and there, within the leagues-long snake that was their line of march, were warriors as fierce as any in the watch. But a good third of them were grouped at either end of the column in Harmer Dogshead's van, and the savage rearguard with its giants, oryx, and fire-flingers. Another third rode with Mance himself near the centre, guarding the wains and sledges and dog-carts that held the great bulk of the host's provisions and supplies, all that remained of the last summer harvest. The rest divided into small bands under the likes of Rattleshirt, Jarl, Tormund, Giantsbane, and the Weeper served as outriders, foragers, and whips, galloping up and down the column endlessly to keep it moving in a more or less orderly fashion. And even more telling, only 1 in 100 wildlings was mounted. The old bear would go through them like an axe through porridge. And when that happened, Mansmith gave chase with his centre to try and blunt the threat. If he should fall in the fight that must follow, the wall would be safe for another 100 years, John judged. And if not, he flexed the burnt fingers of his sword hand. Longclaw was slung to his saddle, the carved stone wolf's head pommel and soft leather grip of the great bastard sword within easy reach. The snow was falling heavily by the time they caught Tormund's band several hours later. Ghosts departed along the way, melting into the forest at the scent of prey. The direwolf would return when they made camp for the night, by dawn at the latest. However far he prowled, Ghost always came back. And so, it seemed, did Ygritte.
"So," the girl called when she saw him, "do you believe us now, Jon Snow? Did you see the giants on their mammoths?"
"Ah!" shouted Tormund before Jon could reply. "The crow's in love. He means to marry one."
"A giantess?" Longspear Rick laughed.
"No, a mammoth!" Tormund bellowed. "Ha! Ha! Ha!"
Ygritte trotted beside John as he slowed his garron to a walk. She claimed to be 3 years older than him, though she stood half a foot shorter. However old she might be, the girl was a tough little thing. Stone Snake had called her a spear wife when they'd captured her in the Skirling Pass. She wasn't wed, and her weapon of choice was a short curved bow of horn and weirwood, but spear wife fit her all the same. She reminded him a little of his sister, Arya, though Arya was younger and probably skinnier. It was hard to tell how plump or thin Ygritte might be with all the furs and skin she wore.
"Do you know the last of the giants?"
Without waiting for an answer, Ygritte said, "You need a deeper voice than mine to do it proper. Then she sang, "Oh, I am the last of the giants. My people are gone from the earth." Tormund Giantsbane heard the words and grinned.
"The last of the great mountain giants who ruled all the world at my birth," he bellowed back through the snow.
Longspear Rick joined in, singing, "Oh, the small folk have stolen my forests. They've stolen my rivers and hills."
"And they've built a great wall through my valleys and fished all the fish from my rills."
Ygritte and Tormund sang back at him in turn in suitable gigantic voices. Tormund's sons, Toreg and Dormund, added their deep voices as well. Then his daughter Munda and all the rest. Others began to bang their spears on leathern shields to keep rough time, until the whole war band was singing as they rode.
"In stone halls they burn their great fires, in stone halls they forge their sharp spears. When I walk alone in the mountains, with no true companions but tears, oh, they hunt me with dogs in the daylight, they hunt me with torches at night. For these men who are small can never stand tall, while giants still walk in the light. Oh, I am the last of the giants, so learn well the words of my song. For when I am gone, the singing will fade, and the silence shall last long and long."
There were tears on Ygritte's cheeks when the song ended. "Why are you weeping?" John asked. "It was only a song. There are hundreds of giants. I've just seen them." "Oh, hundreds," she said furiously. "You know nothing, Jon Snow. You, Jon." Jon turned at the sudden sound of wings. Blue-gray feathers filled his eyes as sharp talons buried themselves in his face. Red pain lanced through him sudden and fierce as pinions beat around his head. He saw the beak, but there was no time to get a hand up or reach for a weapon. John reeled backward. His foot lost the stirrup. His garron broke in panic, and then he was falling, and still the eagle clung to his face, its talons tearing at him as it flapped and shrieked and pecked. The world turned upside down in a chaos of feathers and horseflesh and blood, and then the ground came up to smash him. The next he knew, he was on his face, with the taste of mud and blood in his mouth, and Ygritte kneeling over him protectively, a bone dagger in her hand. He could still hear wings, though the eagle was not in sight. Half his world was black.
"My eye,"
he said in sudden panic, raising a hand to his face.
"It's only blood, Jon Snow. He missed the eye. Just ripped your skin up some."
His face was throbbing. Tormund stood over them, bellowing, he saw from his right eye, as he rubbed blood from his left. Then there were hoofbeats, shouts, and the clacking of old dry bones.
"Bag of bones!" roared Tormund. "Call off your Elcrow!" "There's your Elcrow,"
Rattleshirt pointed at John,
"bleeding in the mud, like a faithless dog."
The eagle came flapping down to land atop the broken giant's skull that served him for his helm.
"I'm here for him." "Come, take him then," said Tormund. "But best come with sword in hand, for that's where you'll find mine. Might be I'll boil your bones and use your skull to piss in. Ha! Once I prick you and let the air out, you'll shrink down smaller than that girl. Stand aside, or Mance will hear of this."
Ygritte stood.
"What? Is it Mance who wants him?"
"I said so, didn't I? Get him up on those black feet."
Tormund frowned down at John.
"Best go, if it's a Mance who's wanting you."
Ygritte helped pull him up.
"He's bleeding like a butchered boar. Look what Orel did to his sweet face."
"Can a bird hate?" John had slain the wildling, Orel, but some part of the man remained within the eagle. The golden eyes looked out on him with cold malevolence. "I'll come," he said. The blood kept running down into his right eye, and his cheek was a blaze of pain. When he touched it, his black gloves came away stained with red. "Let me catch my Garen." It was not the horse he wanted so much as Ghost, but the dire wolf was nowhere to be seen. He could be leagues away by now, ripping out the throat of some elk. Perhaps that was just as well. The Garen shied away from him when he approached, no doubt frightened by the blood on his face. But John calmed him with a few quiet words and finally got close enough to take the reins. As he swung back into the saddle, his head whirled. "I will need to get this tended," he thought, "but not just now. Let the king beyond the wall see what his eagle did to me." His right hand opened and closed, and he reached down for Longclaw and slung the bastard sword over a shoulder before he wheeled to trot back to where the Lord of Bones and his band were waiting. Ygritte was waiting too, sitting on her horse with a fierce look on her face. "I am coming too. Be gone." The bones of Rattleshirt's breastplate clattered together. "Or you were sent for the crow come down, none other." "A free woman rides where she will," Ygritte said. The wind was blowing snow into John's eyes. He could feel the blood freezing on his face. "Are we talking or riding?"
"Riding," said the Lord of Bones.
It was a grim gallop. They rode 2 miles down the column, through swirling snows, then cut through a tangle of baggage wains to splash across the milk water, where it took a great loop towards the east. A crust of thin ice covered the river shallows. With every step, their horses' hooves crashed through until they reached the deeper water 10 yards out. The snow seemed to be falling even faster on the eastern bank, and the drifts were deeper, too. Even the wind is colder. And night was falling, too. But even through the blowing snow, the shape of the great white hill that loomed above the trees was unmistakable. The fist of the first men. John heard the scream of the eagle overhead. A raven looked down from a soldier pine and quacked as he went past. Had the old bear made his attack? Instead of the clash of steel and the thrum of arrows taking flight, John heard only the soft crunch of frozen crust beneath his Garen's hooves. In silence, they circled round to the south slope, where the approach was easiest. It was there at the bottom that John saw the dead horse, sprawled at the base of the hill, half buried in the snow. Entrails spilled from the belly of the animal like frozen snakes, and one of its legs was gone. Wolves, was John's first thought, but that was wrong. Wolves eat their kill. More Garens were strewn across the slope, legs twisted grotesquely, blind eyes staring in death. The wildlings crawled over them like flies, stripping them of saddles, bridles, packs, and armor, and hacking them apart with stone axes.
"Up!" Rattleshirt told John. "Mance is up top!"
Outside the ring wall, they dismounted to squeeze through a crooked gap in the stones. The carcass of a shaggy brown Garen was impaled upon the sharpened stakes the old bear had placed inside every entrance. He was trying to get out, not in. There was no sign of a rider. Inside was more and worse. John had never seen pink snow before. The wind gusted around him, pulling at his heavy sheepskin cloak. Ravens flapped from one dead horse to the next. Are those wild ravens, or our own? John could not tell. He wondered where poor Sam was now, and what he was. A crust of frozen blood crunched beneath the heel of his boot. The wildlings were stripping the dead horses of every scrap of steel and leather, even prying the horseshoes off their hooves. A few were going through packs they'd turned up, looking for weapons and food. John passed one of Chet's dogs, or what remained of him, lying in a sludgy pool of half-frozen blood. A few tents were still standing at the far side of the camp, and it was there they found Mance Rayder. Beneath his slash cloak of black wool and red silk, he wore black ringmail
and shaggy fur breeches, and on his head was a great bronze and iron helm with raven wings at either temple. Jarl was with him, and Harmer the dog's head, Stir as well, and Varamir Sixskins with his wolves and his shadow cat. The look Mance gave John was grim and cold.
"What happened to your face?"
Ygritte said.
"Orel tried to take his eye out."
"It was him," I asked. "Has he lost his tongue? Perhaps he should, to spare us further lies."
Stir the Magnar drew a long knife.
"The boy might see more clear with one eye instead of two."
"Would you like to keep your eye, John?" asked the king beyond the wall. "If so, tell me how many they were. And try and speak the truth this time, bastard of Winterfell."
John's throat was dry. "My lord, what—"
"I am not your lord," said Mance. "And the what is plain enough. Your brothers died. The question is, how many?"
John's face was throbbing. The snow kept coming down, and it was hard to think. "You must not balk whatever is asked of you," Corrin had told him. The words stuck in his throat, but he made himself say, "There were 300 of us."
"Us?"
Man said sharply. "Them. 300 of them." "Whatever is asked," the half-hand said. "So why do I feel so craven?" 200 from Castle Black and 100 from the Shadow Tower."
"There's a truer song than the one you sang in my tent."
Mance looked to Harmer Dogshead.
"How many horses have we found?"
"More than 100, the huge woman replied. "Less than 2. There's more dead to the east, under the snow. Hard to know how many."
Behind her stood her banner-bearer, holding a pole with a dog's head on it, fresh enough to still be leaking blood.
"You should never have lied to me, John Snow," said Mance.
I know that." What could he say? The Wilding King studied his face.
"Who had the command here? And tell me true. Was it Riker? Smallwood? Not Withers, he's too feeble. Whose tent was this?"
"I have said too much." "You did not find his body?" Harmer snorted, her disdain thrusting from her nostrils.
"What fools these black crows be!"
"The next time you answer me with a question, I will give you to my Lord of Bones,"
Mance Rayder promised John.
He stepped closer. "Who led here?"
One more step, thought John. Another foot. He moved his hand closer to Longclaw's hilt. "If I hold my tongue—"
"Reach up for that bastard sword, and I'll have your bastard head off before it clears the scabbard," said Mance. "I'm fast losing patience with you, crow."
"Say it," Ygritte urged. "He's dead, whoever he was."
His frown cracked the blood on his cheek. "This is too hard," John thought in despair. "How do I play the turn cloak without becoming one?" Corrin had not told him that. But the second step is always easier than the first. The old bear.
"That old man?"
Harmer's tone said she did not believe it.
"He came himself? Then who commands at Castle Black?"
"Bowen Marsh." This time John answered at once. "You must not balk whatever is asked of you." Mance laughed.
"If so, our war is won. Bowen knows a deal more about counting swords than he's ever known about using them."
"The old bear commanded," said John. This place was high and strong, and he made it stronger. He dug pits and planted stakes, laid up food and water. He was ready for—
"Me?"
finished Mance Rayder.
"Aye, he was. Had I been fool enough to storm this hill, I might have lost 5 men for every crow I slew, and still counted myself lucky."
His mouth grew hard.
"But when the dead walk, walls and stakes and swords mean nothing. You cannot fight the dead, John Snow. No man knows that half so well as me.
He gazed up at the darkening sky and said,
"The crows may have helped us more than they know. I'd wondered why we'd suffered no attacks. But there's still 100 leagues to go, and the cold is rising. Varamyr, send your wolf sniffing after the whites. I won't have them taking us unawares. My Lord of Bones, double all the patrols, and make certain every man has torch and flint. Stir, Jarl, you ride at first light."
"Mance," Rattleshirt said, "I want me some crow bones."
Ygritte stepped in front of John.
"You can't kill a man for lying to protect them as was his brothers."
"They are still his brothers," declared Stir.
"They're not,"
insisted Ygritte.
"He never killed me like they told him, and he slew the half-hand we all saw."
John's breath misted the air. "If I lie to him, he'll know." He looked Mance Rayder in the eyes, opened and closed his burned hand. "I wear the cloak you gave me, Your Grace."
"A sheepskin cloak," said Ygritte, "and there's many a night we danced beneath it, too."
Jarl laughed, and even Harmer Dugshead smirked.
"Is that the way of it, Jon Snow?"
asked Mance Rayder mildly.
"Her and you."
It was easy to lose your way beyond the wall. John did not know that he could tell honour from shame any more, or right from wrong. "Father, forgive me." "Yes," he said. Mance nodded.
"Good. You'll go with Jarl and Stirl and the morrow, then, both of you. Far be it from me to separate two hearts that beat as one."
"Go where?" asked John.
"Over the wall. It's past time you proved your faith with something more than words, Jon Snow."
The Magna was not pleased.
"What do I want with a crow?"
"He knows the watch, and he knows the wall," said Mance, "and he knows Castle Black better than any raider ever could. You'll find a use for him, or you're a fool."
Stir scowled. "His heart may still be black."
"Then cut it out."
Mance turned to Rattleshirt.
"My Lord of Bones, keep the column moving at all costs. If we reach the wall before Mormont, we've won."
"They'll move."
Rattleshirt's voice was thick and angry. Mance nodded and walked away, Harmer and six skins beside him. Varamyr's wolves and Shadowcat followed behind. John and Ygritte were left with Jarl, Rattleshirt, and the Magna. The two older wildlings looked at John with ill-concealed rancor as Jarl said,
"You heard. We ride at daybreak. Bring all the food you can. There'll be no time to hunt. And have your face seen to, Crow. You look a bloody mess."
"I will," said John.
"You'd best not be lying, girl,"
Rattleshirt said to Ygritte, his eyes shining behind the giant skull. John drew Longclaw. "Get away from us, unless you want what Corrin got."
"You got no wolf to help you here, boy."
Rattleshirt reached for his own sword.
"Sure of that, are ya?"
Ygritte laughed. Atop the stones of the ring wall, Ghost hunched with white fur bristling. He made no sound, but his dark red eyes spoke blood. The Lord of Bones moved his hand slowly away from his sword, backed off a step, and left them with a curse. Ghost padded beside their garrons as John and Ygritte descended the fist. It was not until they were halfway across the milk water that John felt safe enough to say, "I never asked you to lie for me."
"I never did," she said. "I left out part, is all.
You said that we fuck beneath your cloak many a night. I never said when we started, though."
The smile she gave him was almost shy.
"Find another place for ghosts to sleep tonight, Jon Snow. It's like Mance said, deeds is truer than words."
Samwell. The sea made Samwell Tarly green sick. It was not all his fear of drowning, though that was surely some of it. It was the motion of the ship as well, the way the decks rolled beneath his feet. "I have a queasy belly," he confessed to Darian the day they sailed from Eastwatch by the sea. The singer slapped him on the back and said, "With a belly big as yours, Slayer, this is a lot of queas." Sam tried to keep a brave face on him for Gilly's sake, if little else. She had never seen the sea before. When they were struggling through the snows after fleeing Craster's keep, they had come on several lakes, and even those had been a wonder to her. As Blackbird slipped away from shore, the girl began to tremble, and big salt tears rolled down her cheeks. "Gods be good," Sam heard her whisper. Eastwatch vanished first, and the wall grew smaller and smaller in the distance, until it finally disappeared. The wind was coming up by then. The sails were the faded grey of a black cloak that had been washed too often, and Gilly's face was white with fear. "This is a good ship," Sam tried to tell her. "You don't have to be afraid." But she only looked at him, held her baby tighter, and fled below. Sam soon found himself clutching tightly to the gunwale and watching the sweep of the oars. The way they all moved together was somehow beautiful to behold and better than looking at the water. Looking at the water only made him think of drowning. When he was small, his lord father had tried to teach him how to swim by throwing him into the pond beneath Horn Hill. The water had gotten in his nose and in his mouth and in his lungs, and he coughed and wheezed for hours after Sir Hyle pulled him out. After that, he never dared go in any deeper than his waist. The Bay of Seals was a lot deeper than his waist and not so friendly as that little fish pond below his father's castle. Its waters were grey and green and choppy, and the wooded shore they followed was a snarl of rocks and whirlpools. Even if he could kick and crawl that far somehow, the waves were like to smash him up against some stone and break his head to pieces. "Looking for mermaids, Slayer?" asked Darian when he saw Sam staring off across the bay. Fair-haired and hazel-eyed, the handsome young singer out of Eastwatch looked more like some dark prince than a black brother. "No." Sam did not know what he was looking for or what he was doing on this boat. "Going to the Citadel to forge a chain and be a maester, to be of better service to the watch," he told himself. But the thought just made him weary. He did not want to be a maester with a heavy chain wrapped around his neck, cold against his skin. He did not want to leave his brothers, the only friends he'd ever had, and he certainly did not want to face the father who had sent him to the wall to die. It was different for the others. For them, the voyage would have a happy ending. Gilly would be safe at Horn Hill, with all the width of Westeros between her and the horrors she had known in the haunted forest. As a serving maid in his father's castle, she would be warm and well-fed, a small part of a great world she could never have dreamed of as Craster's wife. She would watch her son grow up big and strong and become a huntsman or a stable hand or a smith. If the boy showed any aptitude for arms, some knight might even take him as a squire. Master Aemon was going to a better place as well. It was pleasant to think of him spending whatever time remained him bathed by the warm breezes of Old Town, conversing with his fellow maesters and sharing his wisdom with acolytes and novices. He had earned his rest 100 times over. Even Darian would be happier. He had always claimed to be innocent of the rape that sent him to the wall, insisting that he belonged at some lord's court, singing for his supper. Now he would have that chance. John had named him a recruiter to take the place of a man named Yoren, who had vanished and was presumed dead. His task would be to travel the Seven Kingdoms, singing of the valor of the Night's Watch, and from time to time returning to the wall with new recruits. The voyage would be long and rough, no one could deny that, but for the others at least there would be a happy end. That was Sam's solace. "I am going for them," he told himself, "for the night's watch and for the happy ending." The longer he looked at the sea, though, the colder and deeper it appeared. But not looking at the water was even worse, Sam realized, in the cramped cabin beneath the stern castle that the passengers were sharing. He tried to take his mind off the roiling in his stomach by talking with Gilly as she nursed her son. "This ship will take us as far as Braavos," he said. "We'll find another ship to carry us to Old Town. I read a book about Braavos when I was small. The whole city is built in a lagoon on 100 little islands, and they have a titan there, a stone man hundreds of feet high. They have boats instead of horses, and their mummers play out written stories instead of just making up the usual stupid farces. The food is very good too, especially the fish. They have all kinds of clams and eels and oysters fresh from their lagoon. We ought to have a few days between ships. If we do, we can go and see a mummer show and have some oysters." He thought that would excite her. He could not have been more wrong. Gilly peered at him with flat, dull eyes, looking through some strands of unwashed hair. "If you want, my lord." "What do you want?" Sam asked her. "Nothing." She turned away from him and moved her son from one breast to the other. The motion of the boat was stirring up the eggs and bacon and fried bread that Sam had eaten before the ship set out. All at once he could not stand the cabin one more instant. He pushed himself back to his feet and clambered up the ladder to give his breakfast to the sea. The sickness came on Sam so strongly that he did not stop to gauge which way the wind was blowing, so he retched from the wrong rail and ended up spattering himself. Even so, he felt much better afterward, though not for long. The ship was Blackbird, the largest of the Watch's galleys. Stormcrow and Talon were faster, Cotter Pike told Maester Aemon back at Eastwatch by the sea, but they were fighting ships, lean, swift birds of prey, where the rowers sat on open decks. Blackbird was a better choice for the rough waters of the narrow sea beyond Skagos. "There have been storms," Pike warned them. "Winter storms are worse, but autumns are more frequent." The first 10 days were calm enough as Blackbird crept across the Bay of Seals, never out of sight of land. It was cold when the wind was blowing, but there was something bracing about the salt smell in the air. Sam could hardly eat, and when he did force something down, it did not stay down for long. But aside from that, he did not do too badly. He tried to bolster Gilly's courage and give her what cheer he could, but that proved hard. She would not come up on deck, no matter what he said, and seemed to prefer to huddle in the dark with her son. The babe liked the ship no more than his mother did, it seemed. When he was not squalling, he was retching up his mother's milk. His bowels were loose and always moving, staining the furs that Gilly wrapped him in to keep him warm and filling the air with a brown stench. No matter how many tallow candles Sam lit, the smell of shit persisted. It was more pleasant out in the open air, especially when Darien was singing. The singer was known to Blackbird's oarsmen and would play for them as they rowed. He knew all their favorite songs, sad ones like "The Day They Hanged Black Robin," "The Mermaid's Lament," and "Autumn of My Day," rousing ones like "Iron Lances" and "Seven Swords for Seven Sons," bawdy ones like "Milady's Supper," "Her Little Flower," and "Meggot Was a Merry Maid, a Merry Maid Was She." When he sang "The Bear and the Maiden Fair," all the oarsmen joined in, and Blackbird seemed to fly across the water. Darien had not been much of a swordsman, Sam knew, from their days training under Alistair Thorne, but he had a beautiful voice. "Honey poured over thunder," Maester Aemon had once called it. He played woodharp and fiddle, too, and even wrote his own songs, though Sam did not think them very good. Still, it was good to sit and listen, though the chest was so hard and splintery that Sam was almost grateful for his fleshy buttocks. "Fat men take a cushion with them wherever they go," he thought. Maester Aemon preferred to spend his days on deck as well, huddled beneath a pile of furs and gazing out across the water. "What is he looking at?" Darien wondered one day. "For him it's as dark up here as it is down in the cabin." The old man heard him. Though Aemon's eyes had dimmed and gone dark, there was nothing wrong with his ears. "I was not born blind," he reminded them. "When last I passed this way, I saw every rock and tree and whitecap, and watched the grey gulls flying in our wake. I was 35, and had been a maester of the chain for 16 years. Egg wanted me to help him rule, but I knew my place was here." He sent me north aboard the Golden Dragon and insisted that his friend Sir Duncan see me safe to Eastwatch. No recruits had arrived at the wall with so much pomp.